think about the economy in a bunch of different ways. What affects us and the people we love? What affects the place or country we live in? What affects the world? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, some big news that affects the world economy.
Thus, as of today, the United States will cease all implementation of the non-binding Paris Accord and the draconian financial and economic burdens the agreement imposes on our country.
So let's start there. The president announced Thursday that the U.S. would leave the Paris Climate Agreement. And since then, a lot of corporate America has responded, well, they wish he hadn't done that, with statements from the CEOs of Disney, GE, Tesla, Amazon, Facebook. So we're going to get into all of this with Marketplace's Scott Tong, who covers sustainability for us. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Lizzie.
So after the president's announcement, you know, we have heard multiple companies, states, even cities say we're going to keep lowering our own emissions. Well, why are they saying that?
Well, let's talk about states and cities first. A lot of states have aggressive targets for introducing renewable energy into their systems, cities as well. They want to be the market for these new technologies. And of course, with this crisis, the slow motion crisis of climate change, it's an opportunity for the companies that make this technology and try to sell it. Companies invest 20, 30, 40 years into the future, and for many of them, they believe this low carbon ship has sailed and they're planning for that future. Let me play you a little bit of tape from an interview we did with a U.S. climate negotiator who worked for the last four administrations, Susan Biniez, on the motivation of companies who wanted the U.S. to stay in.
They obviously think it's more in their economic interest and the interest of the United States to be in than to be out. I think they think they're going to lose out on certain markets in terms of clean energy, technologies, renewables, et cetera. There might be economic sanctions taken against the United States as a non-party to the Paris Agreement.
The president mentioned the U.S. no longer paying into a fund, basically billions of dollars to other countries. He called it redistribution. If the U.S. stops paying in, does that kind of mean the rest of the deal falls apart? What happens?
So an important part of the Paris climate deal was getting all the countries in. And so bringing the developing country into the deal was critical. And part of that was the money, that the rich countries would agree to pay hundreds of billions of dollars for the developing countries to afford the technologies to mitigate climate change and to be able to adapt to it. And here's the thinking. The effect of climate change is largely because of historic emissions, and the rich countries are the biggest historic emitters in the world. So we created the problem in a way and have the money to be able to address this. And the poorer countries in the world, they're the ones who actually are going to be on the receiving end of most of the impacts of climate change. So that was the thinking. If the U.S. pulls its money out of the deal, who fills that hole? That's a significant question, I think, going forward.
I want to fact check some of the things that the president said in his announcement in the Rose Garden.
Sure.
One of them was that the industrial sectors will lose jobs. Is that accurate, the number of jobs lost that he suggested?
So this comes from a study that was funded by coal industry interests. And so many believe it contained a bunch of cherry-picked assumptions that went into the study. One of the assumptions was that, you know, a lot of the decarbonizing that the U.S. was going to do was going to be borne by the industrial sector, you know, steel makers, cement makers, paper factories. It's kind of a curious assumption because, you know, most people believe that you're going to look for the lowest, cheapest carbon reductions first, and those would likely come elsewhere in the economy. So a lot of people are scratching their heads and wondering if that's really the best assumption here.
Another thing he mentioned is that Americans might pay higher energy costs. Is that accurate?
So that goes back to the same study that has a cloud over it. And another assumption that in that study was that there would be minimal innovation in the electricity sector. You know, wind and solar and next generation batteries, a smarter power grid. There are other studies out there that suggest there will be more innovation, that these energies will get cheaper under the Paris deal. Who knows who's going to be right? But again, the question is whether is this another kind of cherry-picked assumption to make Paris compliance as painful as some want it to be?
I want to ask you specifically about China because, of course, before you covered sustainability, you also covered China. And there is this question of global leadership. As the U.S. steps away from this agreement, does China step in?
Certainly China wants to step in. There's an obsession with this notion of soft power, right? Of gaining friends and power through the power of attraction, being a good actor in the world instead of through guns or through GDP. But global goodwill, it takes a long time to build, and it's clear that the Chinese are still figuring that out. This is a great opportunity to be at the center of the table that the U.S. has just left. And so what's happening at the center of the table is there are a lot of technical conversations like how to design markets to cap pollution and trade the credits. And that's what the United States actually invented, how to integrate wind and solar energy into the grid, how to verify that countries are doing what they say. You know, the U.S. had a lot to gain and had a lot of expertise to add to these conversations. And now this is an opportunity many countries want to fill, certainly including the Chinese. Now that the clean energy markets are going to be in places like China and India, they could shape the rules so that Chinese companies benefit from that.
Marketplace's Scott Tong from our sustainability desk. As always, Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, it's Lizzie O'Leary. Real and independent news is more important than ever. And we at Marketplace are here to explain how the economy really works, not just for CEOs and on Wall Street, but for you. And to do that, we need your help, especially at the end of the fiscal year. So head on over to marketplace.org/donate. You can contribute there and help keep us going. Thank you. From U.S. politics, we're going across the pond. That's the chimes of Big Ben at the UK's House of Parliament. And it's almost time, yes, see what I did there? For Britain to go to the polls again. Thursday's election is set against the backdrop of last year's Brexit vote. Remember, that yes vote led to Prime Minister David Cameron stepping down, and now his successor, Theresa May, is hoping to shore up her position. For more on how all of this is playing out, we are joined by Philip Hampshire. He's a business and economics reporter with our partners at the BBC. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Lizzie.
For our American listeners, let's back up a little bit. Why is the UK holding an election now? It sort of seems like everything has its origins in the Brexit vote.
It does a little bit. Part of the reason why the Conservatives wanted to hold an election early was because they were way, way, way up in the polls, like 15, 16% up in the polls. And Theresa May, the current Prime Minister of the UK, who's the head of the Conservative Party, looked like she was going to romp home. Meanwhile, the leader of the Labour Party, he's a little bit unusual. He's the kind of politician that everybody generally says that they want. He's not that polished. He's not big on his spin. He wears brown jackets with leather elbow pads, the kind of man you might imagine smoking a pipe, that kind of thing. And yet he seems to have been quite canny here, because Theresa May, over the course of the last few weeks of this election, has tumbled in the polls.
Theresa May, of course, was also sort of trying to shore up the momentum behind Brexit and support for Brexit. Where do things stand in the process of Britain trying to leave the European Union right now?
Britain at the moment is, with regards to the European Union, a little bit like a cat in the night. It's scratched on the back door, and the cat's owner has opened the back door, and the cat is now staring outside in the dark and deciding if it really wants to go out.
You're going to make me laugh, Philip.
You can imagine the situation. It wants to go out. It doesn't want to go out. It wants to come in. It wants to go back out again. And that's exactly what's going on. As we seem to be moving a little bit further down the track, it is quite clear that nobody really knows quite how these negotiations are going to play out. The relationship between the UK and its traditional trading partners of the last 50 years or so, France, Germany, they've become a little bit more strained. We actually had Angela Merkel at the G7 meeting that happened last weekend accuse the UK of being Donald Trump's stooge in Europe. This is pretty undiplomatic language amongst people who were friends up until a couple of years ago.
When I was in the UK just after the Brexit vote, I talked to a lot of people who were concerned about what would happen to trading relationships or their ability to, you know, move between one country in Europe or another. What are voters most focused on in this election?
It is incredibly difficult to say what voters are most focused on in this election. Yes, the Brexit situation is incredibly important. But if you like, it's already decided. Most of this election was being fought on who do you want to have sitting at the negotiating table with the European Union. And if you like, part of the reason why Theresa May has been tumbling in the polls is people have been thinking, well, actually, maybe she's not the best person to be sitting at the table. And then they look at the alternative as being Jeremy Corbyn and they think, well, I'm not entirely sure I want him there either. And then they look at the third party and they think, well, they're far too small to really count, and so on and so forth as they go down through the list.
That period of uncertainty around negotiations, or this sort of cat maybe leaving the back door, as you've described it, what does that do to markets, to people who like business stability, and to the strength of the pound?
The pound has been going down over the course of most of the last 9 months or so, and it slips every time that the Conservative Party slips further in the polls. Less because the financial markets don't like the Labour Party, though that may indeed be part of it, more because it's quite likely we will end up with what's called a hung parliament, where no party has overall control. And unlike the United States, where there are two parties, here in the UK we have at least seven major parties. So things get a little bit complicated when you start trying to make coalitions that form a cohesive government. That's what's worrying the markets a little bit more. But the fact is, again, it's hard for anyone to make a decision in a position of absolutely zero knowledge on what the end negotiations are going to bring.
Philip Hampshire, a business and economics reporter with our partners at the BBC. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've probably heard me talk about presidential budget requests before. They're a great way to understand a president's priorities, though Congress actually decides who and what get federal money. One thing we can learn from President Trump's budget request, though, is how he views the social safety net. His plan includes deep cuts to it. For example, over 10 years, he'd cut $193 billion from SNAP. That's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps. We've looked at the social safety net a fair amount on Marketplace, but we also wanted to talk about the organizations that act as a backstop to it. We'll get to that in a moment, but first, we hear about what it means to rely on food banks from a handful of people in Nashville. Tennessee Public Radio's Blake Farmer visited a Salvation Army food bank in the state's capital and talked to a few people there.
My name is Raymond Strange, and I work for a Bicentennial Mall down here at the park. Today's one of my off days, and I'm just coming to the pantry to get some extras. Some oatmeal rice and green beans and some raviolis and just spaghetti strings. And I got fresh bread here, too. Very soft. In between pay weeks and months, I use it. When cabinet's low, pay week next week. Hey, we do what we got to do, man. And as long as his door's open, the Salvation Army door open, we welcome to come. I take full advantage of it. My kids ain't hungry. We eating, get to stew. I've seen people get these boxes, and I say, to me that don't look like much, but it is, it is. To knock stamps that, man, on something like this, it would be tough, man. I couldn't even say. I see enough petty stuff happening as it is, and there is stamps, and there is pantries, and there's still some crime and stuff goes on. People get hungry, man. They do what they got to do.
My name is Linda Gray. I've been disabled. They cut my disability off last month. I'm getting help from family and these resources, food banks. Well, I get a box like twice a month. Well, once a month, that box will help.
Did you have any coffee? I want some coffee.
I'll check with that, Sam.
Thank you so much.
What's sort of your thought, Ben, as you hear that the food stamp program is, the administration wants to cut it back substantially? What's sort of been your first take reaction?
I think it's not right. There's people out here homeless and hungry, don't have any means of getting no help.
I'm Stephen Leslie. I don't do anything now. I'm unemployed. I'm a veteran. Every little bit helps. It's real close. You'll come right down to the end of the month when you're about to run out of food. About to run out of food, it's time for the food stamps to kick back in. It depends on how you shop, though. If you shop in bulk, you can make it all right. I never go completely out of food, but I get low sometimes. I kind of kick back on my eating. I don't eat it. I eat less. I can do that.
This food pantry is supplied by an organization called Second Harvest Food Bank of Middle Tennessee. Janie Day is president and CEO of Second Harvest. She's been working in food banking for 29 years. Welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
How many people do you all serve?
We have a service area of about 460,000 individuals that have been identified as food insecure.
What does it take to feed that many people? You know, how much money are we talking about? What kind of staff are we talking about?
Well, we have a budget of over $45 million, and we have a staff now of 106 individuals. It takes a lot. We have over 19 trucks that are on the road on a daily basis to be able to provide services. And we have 490 nonprofit agencies, and we are their primary source of food. We are not their only source of food, but it might be a soup kitchen or a domestic violence center or a children's feeding program or a low-income senior citizens high-rise that may need some additional food assistance.
And because we're marketplace, we like to run the numbers. Where does your funding come from?
Well, our funding comes from individuals, about 55%. It also comes from foundations. It comes from corporations. And only about 11% comes from government and from other civic organizations.
When we talk about that 11%, how closely do you watch things in Washington, like the proposed budget that came out from President Trump, or, say, the reauthorization of the Farm Bill, which put some money behind supplementary nutrition assistance, which most people know as food stamps?
It does affect us, and we watch it very, very closely. We are a member of Feeding America, which is made up of over 200 food banks across the country that serve every county and every state in the United States. And what we're doing is feeding hungry people. And so when you have cutbacks in federal programs, it is going to impact the work that we do, and it will impact our strategies, who we serve, how we serve them, and what is it going to cost.
Well, when you hear something like proposed, you know, cuts to SNAP, billions of dollars, what happens on your end?
Usually what it means is we're going to have to raise more money and more funds if these cuts go into place at any level, and we'll have to raise more awareness about the issue of hunger and how our neighbors are struggling to put food on their tables, or we're going to have to cut back services.
Does this also mean that you have to put contingency plans in place for Second Harvest?
Yes. And so we talk a lot about that. Until we know what the actual impact is going to be, we play out a lot of different scenarios. You know, one of the things that I was looking at on SNAP participation here just in Davidson County, which is a very urban county, we're doing quite well. Our unemployment rate is at 3%. So we've seen a decrease in the amount of people who are utilizing food stamps. But if you go to a county like Gibson County, out in the western part of our service area, where unemployment is 15.8%, that's a different story. For those individuals that live in that community, the cuts in SNAP and other federal nutrition programs will have a huge impact. And so we have to be ready to that. We're going to apply a different strategy there than perhaps we would in the urban area that we serve as well.
Before I let you go, I'm just curious, are there things that you think our audience might not know or fully understand about the work you do? You know, they're hearing this interview, and maybe this is the first time that they have thought about this issue. What do you want them to know?
I guess I want them to know that hunger can affect any of us at any time in our lifetime. With people living on the edge, people working two jobs, trying to be feed their families, sometimes it's extremely difficult. And it's not because they don't want to work and they don't want a job, because I know and I talk to people every day, everybody wants a job. But they need a good paying job. So if we had affordable housing, if we had affordable health care, and we had living wages for everyone, there really wouldn't be a need for food banks across the country.
Do you view your job or the work you do as a backstop to the social safety net?
Unfortunately, we're a supplemental feeding program. We're not a permanent feeding program. But we were established to help meet the need when government or private industry or other organizations could not provide that need. So we are the safety net. We are here to provide for those when nobody else can. And so I think it's critical for our organization and for the people that we serve that we exist. My goal would be for someday for us not to exist. If we could eliminate hunger in this country, and I believe that we can, I would love it if we could close our doors and nobody needed our food assistance. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen. But would I like to see it reduce and the numbers to become less and less? Absolutely.
Janie Day, the president and CEO of Second Harvest Food Bank of Middle Tennessee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you have comments on life within the social safety net, we want to hear from you. Or perhaps, like Janie Day, you work for an organization that acts as a backup to the social safety net. Just share your experience with us. Our email is weekend@marketplace.org. You can also follow our team on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. From making ends meet to finding your first job, getting a summer gig as a teen is hard. One reason why, the decline of malls. That's according to data from placement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas. For more on this economic rite of passage and how it's changed in 2017, we have Matt Sargent. He's Senior Vice President at Magid, a retail consulting firm. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
So I'm 41, and I think about a mall as, you know, a place I went as a young teen or a teenager,
right.
And among other things, you know, not just being a place to hang out, but that was where people got their first jobs. What does all of this mean, you know, for your high school kid or someone who's saving up for college who would have had a job there, say, 15 years ago?
Well, I think what it means is that the transactional side of retail is struggling. And what I mean by that is the jobs that we not only, you know through the mall, but also a lot of us had and got us our first start in retail are becoming fewer and far between. So it's really hitting front and center that beginning worker who's just getting their first experience in the professional workplace.
I mean, I would guess that that sort of has two effects. You know, number one, younger people don't get early work experience in the same way. And number two, the jobs that are there still, are they going to someone who's a little older or has a family?
Definitely. And I think that that's the flip side is that in order to compete, what you're seeing is physical retailers are having to double down on the relationship side. And those are the jobs you really see expanding in retail and retailers investing more aggressively in. So, you know, a good example is if you look at Best Buy and their blue shirts, those are more experienced salespeople. They're really involved. They tend to stay at the retailer longer, and that's where the retailers have to win. What that means is if you're somebody who's coming in off the street or only planning to be at a job for a few months, you go to the back of the line, and that's really a double hit for anyone that's younger and trying to get into the retail space.
You know, I was looking at some statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics before we came in here. And one of the things that they pointed out is that if you are a teen who gets some experience in the job market, that actually tends to serve you well kind of throughout your life. It teaches you time management and you get more attached to, you know, having a job, learning things about the workforce. Well, what happens to this generation coming up if those kind of jobs are much harder to come by.
I think it's a much bigger issue, and I think you know, if I compare it to the generations past and my personal experience, I mean, my first job was as a grocery checker,
and so I worked at a sandwich shop.
Exactly. I won't tell you how much below $4 an hour I made, but that was a time when minimum wage was pretty low, and that was the entry job that I was able to get at. But what that allowed me to do, and I think allows a large percentage of people to do, is get in and understand time management. What I think that means for teenagers today is they have to be much more proactive in planning their career. It's much more of a requirement that you think through what that job will be and how that job can evolve from the transactional roles that are becoming fewer and far between in a more relationship-based job. And a good example, I think, is a retailer by the name of Aviva. So Aviva is actually – they're owned by Lululemon, and they have this brand that's focused on basically fitness for kids under 14. It's primarily staffed by younger people, teens, and the goal is to really allow them to have a relationship with the younger shopper. What's imperative is that if you are someone who's passionate about retail, passionate about fitness wear, you need to seek out jobs like that, as opposed to maybe 15 or 20 years ago when you just kind of showed up for a series of jobs knowing that, hey, this is my first job. I'm just going to learn a lot.
I mean, I get that. But man, that seems like a lot of pressure for, you know, a 16-year-old who is also maybe just trying to save for school.
Exactly. And I think the pressure is mounting for teenagers to be much more proactive and much more thoughtful in their career development at a much earlier stage. And I agree that pressure was not there 20 years ago, and it seems like it's just one of many pressures that we're putting upon teens today.
Matt Sargent, Senior Vice President from the retail consulting firm Magid, thank you so much.
Thank you much. Appreciate it.
So let's hear what it's like from, you know, an actual teenager. We called up Eleanor Fawcett. She's a junior at La Cañada High School just outside Los Angeles. She works part-time at a daycare center after school.
It's pretty stressful, but I really enjoy my job. And so I don't feel stressed when I work. So it's kind of a nice break between homework and school.
And getting that job experience is really important for teens like Eleanor.
I find that all the opportunities I have now have all been in the child development field because right now I think I want to do child development, but I don't have other opportunities. I've never had the opportunity to work retail. I've never done anything, basically any other job career. And it's kind of scary because I might decide that I don't want to do child development, and then I will have spent all this time just on this one little area.
That kind of pressure to get work experience and pick a career path, something we just talked about with Matt Sargent, and Eleanor feels like it's a bit much.
I just feel like right now we have to decide so soon because our classes we take in high school are all tailored around what we think we want to major in.
But her parents try to reassure her that she doesn't need all of the answers just yet.
So even if it's not the most glamorous job and it doesn't pay well, just do something you want to do, and that's all that matters.
Next week, we're going to be looking at jobs more closely for recent graduates. It's a special we're calling Life After College, so parents and caregivers, yeah, we want to hear from you too. We'll have Allison Green of Ask a Manager and Brian Kelly, who you may know as the points guy, on hand with advice. Got questions about getting your career started or navigating your credit card finances? Just email us at weekend@marketplace.org, and those two might be able to help you sort out your questions next week. You can also find more details at marketplace.org. If you know Marketplace, you know we love our numbers. It's kind of our signature thing. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers Eliza Mills and Tony Wagner as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Start us off, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
400.
That's how many dollars Back to the Future superfan Spencer LeGrand White has to pay for a speeding ticket.
White was cruising down the freeway in his DeLorean.
The speed gun caught him going 88 miles per hour, which, of course, in the Back to the Future movies, is the magic number that will send the car and its occupants back through time.
White and his speeding ticket seem to be staying in 2017, but he doesn't seem mad about it.
In fact, he plans to frame his ticket and bring it with him when he takes the DeLorean out to car shows.
Over 1.5 million.
That's how many times the song Liar Liar by Captain Ska has been viewed on YouTube, at least at our last count.
The UK hit is a scathing criticism of Prime Minister Theresa May and hit number 2 on the chart this week.
As the June 8th British general election approaches, May has come under fire for flip-flopping on key positions.
Some stations, including the BBC, aren't playing the song so as to stay impartial during the election, but that hasn't stopped the views rolling in online.
30.
That's how many years the GIF file format has been around.
In the 1990s, they started off as still images and evolved into those looping animations that spread like wildfire on Twitter.
In the past few decades, GIFs have become integral to social media communication.
And in 2012, the Oxford Dictionary has declared GIF the word of the year.
Man, it really has been a wild ride.
I mean, who could forget all our best friends? The Meryl Streep fist pumping at the Oscars, the Obama mic drop, or like all the Jim Halpert GIFs.
Tony, I don't think words can really do them justice.
You're so right.
Here are some more numbers. In 2015, Americans spent more money at restaurants than they did on groceries for the first time in recorded history. And it has never been easier not to cook. It seems like if you're willing to pay enough, there is an app that will bring just about any food to your door. And then there's the market for delivery meal kits. You do the cooking, but the recipe and the ingredients are provided. But come on, what do you save when you shop and cook for yourself? I mean, is it really that hard?
It's true. I mean, it does take time. You do have to put some forethought into it. But if you put the forethought into it, it takes less time. The big thing I would say to that is it doesn't take as much time as you think it does. It doesn't take as much money as you think it does. It doesn't take as much energy as you think it does.
That's David Tamarkin, editor-in-chief of Epicurious. He made 90 meals in the month of May as part of his yearly Cook 90 Challenge. And in his 3 years living in New York City, he's never even ordered delivery.
I'm not against restaurants. I'm not against restaurant delivery, although I will say I've never gotten restaurant delivery here in this house. Since I've lived in New York this time, about almost 3 years, I've not gotten any delivery.
In 3 years in New York?
Yeah.
Whoa, man.
Yeah, I know. It's weird that I think about it.
Trust me, as a New Yorker, that's amazing. David invited us over to cook in his apartment in Brooklyn. We spent about $25 on this meal for four. It was a delicious dinner of mussels and chorizo in beer broth.
It takes a lot of energy and time and money to cook if you don't cook on a regular basis. That's the thing that bothers me, is that I feel there's a lot of messaging out in the world right now that cooking is very hard. They really put cooking out there as the enemy.
I am someone who relaxes by cooking. I like the tactile feel. I, you know, spend my day doing super brainy things. So I like kind of winging it and experimenting. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people don't. It stresses them out. Mm-hmm. How do you say to someone who is, you know, a beginning cook, put down your phone, don't click and order that thing. Try this at home.
I guess for beginner cooks, I would say really just try not to have any expectations. Like, just try if you can to have all pressure off. I know it is like a high pressure thing because you're investing time and money into it. But I guess I would say start really simple and start with like pasta. Taking things that are coming in season, like herbs, I would put lemon zest in there, asparagus, anything fresh vegetable that can cook quickly, and take the hot pasta, drain it, and pour it in there. Pour it right over those ingredients so they cook very gently with the hot pasta, and then you're done. If you put a lot of cheese in there, it's going to be good. If you salt it right, it's going to be good. And kind of no matter what, you can't really go wrong with that. So I would just encourage people to start that easily and that small like that.
How much money do you think you save by cooking at home?
significant amounts of money, I think.
Really?
Not as much as you might assume because groceries are expensive. And I will splurge on myself because it sometimes like, well, I'm not eating out at a restaurant, so I will buy this nice piece of fish or I will buy this nice piece of cheese. Cheese can really get you. When I'm not doing Cook 90 and I fall out of practice of cooking every day, I will go to work. I will go to the work cafeteria. I will buy 3 hard-boiled eggs in the cafeteria every morning and a piece of toast. The toast, I mean, no offense to my work cafeteria, but it's not good food, and I pay $3.50 for it every morning, and then I'll go back for lunch and get a very mediocre salad that runs about $7 or $8. So right there, you're looking at, you know, $12.50. I might get like a coffee in the afternoon. I'm spending probably about $15 a day to bring that stuff to work, which is what I do. I bring simple stuff. I do bring hard-boiled eggs or overnight oats or, you know, and salads to work. That, I think I'm spending a third of what I was pay at the cafeteria.
All right. Tell me what you're doing.
I decided to just, we're just going to do half the onion because okay. We don't want to, we're eating mussels, not onions. I'm actually going to start sweating this, actually, in some olive oil.
We are surrounded by businesses that, you know, want to deliver all the ingredients of a meal to your door. Meal kits are everywhere. I, you know, you can't listen to a podcast without getting a million ads for a meal kit. Why do this instead?
I'm going to take a deep breath. The pitfalls of the meal kit is that it's built on a false premise that cooking is difficult, that you need to have your ingredients delivered, that it's easier to have this done for you. It's not the way to learn how to cook. That's the way to cook a single meal. You learn by having a little extra chorizo in your fridge that you want to use up because you don't want to throw it away. You learn by having, you know, a whole container of cumin in your pantry, not the 2 teaspoons you need, because you're going to like the cumin and you're going to want to use it more in different ways. That's the big joy of being a home cook, of coming into a place where you have some stuff and you can cobble it together. I'm just a little nervous about those onions. Let me just stir those. I'm sorry.
There's something, honestly, about the smell of onions and olive oil that makes my brain go, okay, your work day's over.
Yeah, right? I feel the same way. Let me put it this way about the meal kits. There is a lot lost when you cook from a meal kit. There's a rhythm that's lost. Cooking kits are about assembling and not about cooking. It's certainly cheaper. Don't even get me started on that, because that is crazy from a price standpoint.
I have to ask you about the price point of it, though, because some people will say, well, it seems reasonable to use a meal kit.
The party line, I think, is that actually it's the same price when you consider that you're only paying for the 2 tablespoons of oil, so you don't have to buy the whole bottle. Okay, so for example, for this meal that we're cooking, these mussels, we have these onions cooking in, you know, a tablespoon of oil, and they are, a meal kit will give me that tablespoon of oil, and they'll only charge me for the tablespoon of oil, right? So they'll charge me like 30 cents for that. I think everybody knows that when you buy in bulk, you save money, right? And it doesn't necessarily bother me that they're charging what they need to charge. That's fine. That's business. What bothers me is that they're telling people that it's cheaper or that it's the same price when it's absolutely not. It is in no world cheaper to pay for these tiny, minuscule amounts of ingredients to come to your door. It's in no world better for the environment, because they say, well, you're not wasting any food. The packaging you were wasting is insane to me. It just seems misleading.
It sounds to me like what you're saying, and I'm going to put this in economic terms, is what we're doing now has a far greater return on investment if we think about the $25 that we spent, but also I am watching you get more relaxed and it smells good. And I don't know, this is we're getting something else out of this experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think you said it really well. I think that's all true.
All right, what's happening now? Try those onions.
Okay, so these are, you can see these are, I kind of like what happened here. Some of these got a little dark brown and crispy, but yeah. The rest are golden. I think we are ready to put the chorizo in, and we'll get it a little bit crispy. Oh, and I need to rinse these mussels a little bit.
Do you want me to do that?
Yeah, sure, you can do that.
I would totally cook mussels at home. I've just never done it before.
Well, you know what? And mussels, see what's so crazy and great about mussels is that you think about what they charge for them at restaurants.
Right. And these cost us, what, $6? $7?
$6.99.
Wow. I think I got most of them.
Cool.
All in all, that took us...
30 minutes, maybe? 35 right. minutes?
Yeah, 35 minutes, $25. And this is a beautiful meal. Thank you and cheers.
Thank you.
Last week, we asked all of you to send us your best home-cooked recipes, and we got some great stuff, like Stanton Cagle's turkey tacos, a tasty-sounding chicken chili dish from the Pascos in South Carolina, and this suggestion from Catherine Nelson in Northern California.
Asparagus risotto does not make you feel like you're eating on a budget. It's easy, and it's elegant, and it's delicious. 1 pound of asparagus is about $3. A few cups of arborio rice is about $4. A can of vegetable stock is $1. You'll need a small onion and a clove of garlic. That probably sets you back another $1. And then you need to find a small chunk of the best Parmesan cheese you can find. With the rest of your money, find a nice dry white wine. And the beauty of this recipe is that you'll have plenty left to serve with dinner, or you can drink it while you're stirring your rice.
You can find details of all the dishes mentioned in today's show and a few more ideas. Just visit us on the web at marketplace.org. Plus, you can subscribe to our newsletter, where I give you a recipe every week. Time now for the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we ask people in the spotlight questions about work and money to hear the lessons they've learned along their journey. And this week, since we've been talking about food, we are digging back into our archive to bring you this quiz. Here's producer Haley Hirschman with our guest.
Hi, I'm Anthony Bourdain. I have a show called Parts Unknown. I write books now and again, and I eat a lot.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
Loneliness. Separation from my daughter, existential despair. I'm on the road about 250 days a year. I stay in a lot of beautiful places and look out the window at a lot of beautiful views, but I'm usually alone.
What is something that you bought that you now completely regret buying?
I mean, I've done so many stupid things in my life that buying an object, you know. I mean, there's that Dennis Leary joke, you know, about the 70s, you know, these are your pants on drugs. I'm pretty sure I've made some bad trouser choices over time, but other than that, I ate at Johnny Rockets in an airport once, and it opened up an abyss of depression and self-loathing, a spiral of self-hatred, rage, and despair that lasted weeks. So, yes, that one Johnny Rockets burger was easily the purchase that I regret more than anything in memory.
Do you remember what you had?
I ordered a cheeseburger, and it was delivered with such utter contempt and lack of care that I just, for a time, made me fear for the entire human race and the future of the planet. I mean, it doesn't take much to set me off, obviously. Yeah.
When did you realize that being a food enthusiast could be an actual career?
I guess I'd written Kitchen Confidential. I was still, you know, I thought it would be delusional to expect that I could ever make a living writing. I mean, that's not a reasonable expectation. I was 44 years old. I was still dunking French fries for a living. But after a few months of keeping the job, because I figured this can't last, it just kept going and going. And the restaurant was filled with journalists all the time and people were offering me things. And eventually I reached this point where I thought, if I'm not really stupid and I don't screw up, I might actually be able to make a living doing this for a while. I mean, in the back of my head, I always figured I could go back to brunch. I can always cook brunch. I hate cooking brunch, but I'm good at it, and it's very difficult to find somebody who can crank out, you know, 300 omelets and eggs bennies on a Sunday morning for a bunch of, you know, hungover people who slept together the previous night and now hate each other and are looking for a venue where they can break up without awkwardness. But I'm your guy.
What is your most prized possession?
My most prized possession, like a physical object, is probably my knife made by Bob Kramer. He handmade me a knife, and it is the most terrifyingly expensive, beautiful, object like that I own. I'm almost afraid to use it. It's so gorgeous. I mean, he makes his own steel. There's meteorite in there somewhere. It probably, you could buy a sports car for what it cost. but it is the single most beautiful physical object I own. I've had it for about a year.
So you keep it somewhere special?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're not going to say on the radio?
No. It is a knife of the gods. it's too beautiful to even look at without, you know, just searing a hole right into your soul. I'm afraid that even talking about it, I'm making it dull somehow.
Oh, we'll move on. What was your first job?
My first job was painting a funhouse, murals in a funhouse at Palisades Amusement Park in New Jersey. I did a really bad job, but that was my first exposure. And then Bicycle Messenger in Manhattan. I did that a lot, when I was off from school.
What is something everyone should own, no matter the cost?
Everyone should own a decent chef knife. It doesn't have to be a really expensive one, but a decent one. One that they keep sharp, treat with respect, and know how to use with some degree of competency. Everyone should cook. Everyone should know how to feed themselves, a few basic things. Everyone should know how to make an omelet competently for another person. Everyone should know how to roast a chicken, how to properly rest a steak, a few other basic things. Otherwise, we're lost.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started your career?
Well, look, all I can tell you is this: the most important lesson I ever learned in life that's carried me through everything I do, I learned as a dishwasher. It's really simple. Show up on time, always. Show people that you work with and work for the respect of doing what you said you were going to do, which is, you said you're going to show up at 9 o'clock? Show up at 9 o'clock. It says everything about you. If you do that every day, you show yourself to be the sort of person worth trusting and investing time and effort and friendship and all those other things. If you don't show up on time, it's already a slippery slope.
And on next week's Marketplace Quiz, we hear from Freaks and Geeks actress Linda Cardellini. I'm very excited. We'll have a sneak peek on Twitter. Just follow us. We're at Marketplace WKND. Next week on Marketplace Weekend, we lend a hand to the class of 2017 and figure out how to build a financial life after college. Housing, negotiating your first salary, credit scores, and paying for your personal brand. We'll get into all of it. If you have questions for our experts, just email us at weekend@marketplace.org or follow us on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. And if you miss us during the week, check out the podcast. Just subscribe wherever fine podcasts are sold. And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman, Eliza Mills, and Paulina Velasco. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer, and Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer, and Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.